Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. How did its defeat in the Opium Wars propel China toward its 21st century success? Orville Schell and John DeLurie are here to talk about their new book, Wealth and Power.
What really was important to them was this notion of restoring their country after a fall, and it took a terrible tumble.
Believe it or not, New York was once showered with federal money. In City of Ambition, his first book, Mason Williams tells us about FDR, LaGuardia, and the making of modern New York.
They were able to draw upon really 3 decades worth of robust thinking by policy people about what government could do to improve the quality of life in America's cities.
Julie Bosman is here to give us the behind-the-story details on J.K. Rowling's new book. And Greg Coles will tell us about the bestseller lists.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century is the new book by Orville Schell and John DeLurie. They are both here with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. So the book is a look at modern China through the portraits of 11 people. How did you come to structure the book in that way?
Well, we thought this history, even for us who spent our lives studying it, is very difficult to grapple with. It's very difficult to know when one era begins and another ends, and all of the names of people for someone who's not a China scholar are very hard to remember and recognize. So we thought it would be an interesting conceit to build a history around a whole series of essayistic portraits about iconic people, whether they're writers, intellectuals, officials, revolutionaries, reformers, who propel this history forward.
And how did you sort of contain it in terms of the time span? When does this start, and where? How far do we go up to?
Well, we sort of knew the starting point was the Opium War in the 19th century, because that's how the Chinese learn their own history. You know, they have a very clear beginning date for modern China, and that's the Opium War. So that was obvious. And then we picked the clear standout figure, the subject of the first chapter, Wei Yuan, who's a very interesting kind of reformist thinker from that time, from actually pre-Opium War era. And then another very important goal for our book was that we drove all the way into the present, because, you know, many historians choose to avoid the present. It's called presentism, right? When you're thinking too much about the present, it almost contaminates your historical work. Whereas we very self-consciously wanted to rethink modern Chinese history from the perspective of the last 30 years in China, which is a radically different ending to the story. It's a success story to a great extent now. So we wanted to incorporate the present into the structure of the book, and so we took it all the way up to contemporary figures.
Was there a sort of overarching theme that comes through these 11 portraits?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that was very striking to both John and me was that we as Westerners, I think, were very accustomed to looking at everybody's history in terms of, you know, sort of enlightenment values and teleology, namely that history is sort of going towards, inevitably, towards greater openness. And that sort of democracy, a very Hegelian sort of notion, somehow is the irresistible target toward which it is driving. But when we look back at this stretch of Chinese history, there is a group of people who are very friendly towards the idea of democracy, and there is a democratic tradition that does keep popping up. But I think what was most striking to us was that in every case of all of the people that we looked at, and some we didn't even write about, what really was important to them was this notion of restoring their country after a fall. And it took a terrible tumble from a position of great strength and power, but to restore it to a position of consequence. And the words, the characters, Fuqiang, wealth, and power, which sort of symbolizes that yearning, kept reoccurring like a leitmotif throughout the writings and the lives of all of these people.
And that humiliation is, for them, the opium war.
That is sort of the, you know, we divide our history up into before the birth of Christ and after the birth of Christ. The opium war was kind of a moment of comparable, a sort of line in the sand. After that, China's sort of recognition of its weakness and its humiliating inability to defend itself against the predations of the great powers, including Japan, dawned ever more inescapably.
Do they see their history as sort of an effort to come back from that first great humiliation, or do they see it as a kind of recurring series of humiliations because all has not gone exactly well for China in the 20th century? And
we should stress it's not just the first opium war. You know, there's a first opium war, there's a second opium war. There's a series of military conflicts throughout the 19th century. And in some ways, the most humiliating for China in the period we look at was the Sino-Japanese War in 1894-95, ending with the Treaty of Shimonoseki. So that's been something that, you know, we're reading about the effect that China's defeat to Japan had in that moment where Japan is supposed to be the lesser civilization, barely civilized, and here they rout the Chinese militarily. So in some ways, that humiliation was even worse than the first Opium War. But it's the cumulative effect of defeat after defeat until the dynasty finally collapses in 1912. And then there's a failed political experiment of a republic that goes on for decades more.
And then there's a Japanese occupation,
yes,
to add insult to injury.
And I mean, I think for many Americans today, thinking in more contemporary terms, who are not Chinese specialists, you think, well, that they must be still suffering from the cataclysmic after effects of Mao and of the Great Leap Forward and of the Cultural Revolution. But do they see that as a big, or do you see that as a big turning point?
Well, it's interesting. I think their narrative of victimization, which both Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists and Mao and the communists and people today have woven, you know, doesn't so much include the abuse of the Chinese people by Chinese rulers. It's more projected onto foreigners.
Right.
And in fact, I think we do sort of come to the conclusion that if China does really want to become a respected nation in the world, which I think it profoundly does. And in many ways, it's earned the right, it's gained wealth and power. But what it's not quite yet gained is that respect.
Respect.
And the respect, I think it would be reasonable to suggest, will probably only come after its government treats its own people in a more respectable way.
You mentioned Chiang Kai-shek, and we've talked about Mao, and Deng Xiaoping is also in the book. What about some of the other figures, and how did you kind of decide who to portray?
There are some more obscure figures whose names are hard to pronounce.
And remember.
And we knew our readers would, most of our readers would be blank slates going into them. But we thought it was important to not just profile the people that have some name recognition, but to push a little bit deeper. Because one thing that's very important about the figures who open the book, these 19th century thinkers, is that, again, it's really striking when you look at something like the idea of self-strengthening, which was the reformist agenda in the latter half of the 19th century. And then you look at what Deng Xiaoping did in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s. It's remarkably similar. I mean, there's a way in which Deng Xiaoping went back to a 19th century formula, but did it whole hog. You know, they could only partially do it in the 19th century. Deng, in many ways, implemented self-strengthening successfully. So that's how we chose someone like Feng Guifun, who's the key figure who came up with those ideas. And then, you know, I suppose maybe it was a moment of political correctness, but we certainly were tearing our hair out at one point where we had only men, maybe it was 12 men at that point. And then it sort of hit us that the Empress Dowager Cixi is this obvious, inevitable person. I mean, she is the key political figure in China from 1861 until she dies in 1908. So that's a long stretch of time where she's essentially the paramount leader for large chunks of that time. But she's so difficult to approach that scholars stay away from her.
Why is that?
The sources on her are very limited. you know, what sources we have, much of them were written to slander her, you know. So there's this, and of course, it's for obvious reasons. You have Confucian prejudices against women. You have Western prejudices against conservatives, because she was conceived of as a conservative at the time. But the more we dug into those sources, we found a much more complex figure who actually also shared this wealth and power drive. That was one of the real surprises, is that when you dig down, you find even the Empress Dowager Cixi spoke of this language of wealth and power. She just failed to do it. So she ended up working, I think, even better than we imagined.
And of these obscure or more obscure figures, Orville, was there one that you really wanted to include, and why?
One guy I really wanted to include, and we had to take him out. And he's only in there in sort of a fairly long fragment, is this wonderful writer, Lu Xun, who is a biting, sarcastic, dark, gloomy character in the teens and 20s of the last century. And I felt he so perfectly characterized the kind of dead-end state of China, where nobody could imagine China would ever have a renaissance of any kind. And it was then the sick man of Asia, as one of his contemporaries described his own country. So I don't know, I call me dark and gloomy, but I like these kinds of characters who aren't afraid to really depict things as they really are.
John, did you have a favorite character in the book?
I think the hero of the book for me is another one we haven't mentioned yet, Liang Qichao. And the reason is Liang Qichao, he's very self-aware, and I like that about him. You know, he sort of gets himself, even criticizing himself. And later in life, he says, you know, I would just kind of move from one thing to another.
And who is he?
He's a early 20th century public intellectual, pioneer of journalism, but a kind of political journalism and essayistic writing, a reformer of language and of ideas and of politics, hugely influential in his time. Even when he was living in exile in Japan for 14 years, everyone reads Liang Qichao back in China, you know, from Qing officials to young college students. They're all obsessed with Liang Qichao. And the thing about him is, in a way, he embodies the whole history we look at, which is this movement from one almost desperate searching for some formula that works. You see that within Liang Qichao's own life. And then he comes to something in the end that I can see as quite attractive even now for Chinese. He calls it cosmopolitan nationalism. And he draws on Confucian traditions. He draws on Buddhist traditions. But he's also by now quite deeply learned in Western ideas and Western values. And so he tries to put them together. That's a great project for the next generation of Chinese thinkers to pursue.
You know, this is a country that, unlike any other in the world, sort of evacuated its old identity and has been ever since in an effort to kind of synthetically recreate and then make it incarnate in a new identity. And it's still not over.
We say it's a success now because there are the obvious ways in which China is a huge success economically, but it's also a failure. The key thing now is to recognize the failure in what they're currently doing and evolve to the next state out of it, you know, because there are, I mean, you look at the environmental situation in China, you look at the gap between rich and poor, you look at things like, you know, just basic health care and political freedoms and civil liberties. I mean, these are very serious limitations on the current system. So I think probably Orville and I, in our heart of hearts, are hoping the next chapter of this book or the next few chapters would in fact show how this current failure emerged into something quite different. And that would be consonant with what the history we've seen.
All right. Well, here's to the book reaching many Chinese and American readers. Thank you so much both for being here.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America by Jeffrey Rosen. That's The Supreme Court, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So we have a J.K. Rowling story.
We do. We have a very interesting story that broke from London this week in the Sunday Times of London. There was a little-known book called The Cuckoo's Calling. It was a debut mystery novel that has been out since early April. And this book, which was published by Little Brown, got a little bit of attention, some good reviews, but almost no one bought the book. In the United States, it sold only about 500 copies in hardcover since it went on sale in April. And over the weekend, it was discovered that the author of that book was not a military veteran named Robert Galbraith, but it was one of the biggest authors on the planet, J.K. Rowling.
And this book came out in the UK and in the US simultaneously?
That's right.
Okay. So how did the story break exactly?
So this is a bit of a windy tale, but the way it broke was on Twitter. A columnist for the Sunday Times named India Knight received an anonymous tip on Twitter telling her that the author of The Cuckoo's Calling was not Robert Galbraith, it was J.K. Rowling. India Knight responded to this tweet saying, "How do you know?" And then this person who was anonymous deleted the tweet. India Knight then took this tip to the Sunday Times, told them of the information that she had, and they began their own investigation very quickly. This all happened last week. And they hired someone to compare the text of The Cuckoo's Calling and the Harry Potter books, which, of course, Ms. Rowling wrote. And they tried to determine if there were similarities. They did determine that there were some similarities, but it wasn't conclusive. But they also discovered that these two books share the same editor at Little Brown and the same agent. So they decided very quickly that it was probable that it was J.K. Rowling. They contacted her representative and said, "We want a straight answer on this. Did she write this book?" And to their surprise, they responded by saying, "Yes, she did." And the author released a statement saying that she found the whole thing very liberating.
All right. There's a lot in there. Let's go back before we talk about the similarities between Harry Potter and this crime procedural mystery. Let's talk about the Twitter because, I mean, Twitter has emerged as kind of this area for sources and investigations. Who was the Twitterer? I mean, have they been able to find who had this feed? Who was this person who submitted the anonymous tip?
No one has really discovered a connection between this person and J.K. Rowling. She appears to be someone who doesn't work for the publisher, doesn't work for the publicity firm. There's no obvious connection. But
has someone interviewed her?
Not that I know of. So I think that people are still looking into it.
Okay. Very mysterious, which is suits the material here, because this is not a wizard fantasy book that Rowling has written, and it's very different from her big adult debut last year, The Casual Vacancy. What is this book about?
This book takes place in the UK, and it is kind of a classic mystery novel. It involves a supermodel paparazzi. It's very much outside of what J.K. Rowling is really known for. Now, this is the second book that she's written for adults. Her first book, The Casual Vacancy, came out last year. And that book, of course, was accompanied with an enormous amount of publicity, big reviews, a lot of hype. And I think that while commercially it was a success, it ended up selling more than 2.5 million copies. Critically, it was not as big of a success as the Harry Potter series. Michi Kakutani in the New York Times wrote a review that was not very enthusiastic, and a lot of reviewers really did not care much for this book. So the second novel, which of course came out in April, The Cuckoo's Calling, was really an opportunity for J.K. Rowling to write under a pseudonym, without the context of her celebrity and to see what the reviews would be like when her name wasn't attached to them.
Let's go back to timing. So she finished the Harry Potter books, obviously, quite a number of years ago and then was working on The Casual Vacancy. Has she talked about when she wrote this book? Did she write it after The Casual Vacancy came out, or what's the story there?
She has not said when she wrote the book, what the sequence was. When I asked her publicist in London if she could tell me anything about the process when she wrote it, she said that she couldn't tell me because Ms. Rowling was very busy working on her writing. So not a lot of answers there. But we do know that there is a second novel that was written that was supposed to be published under the name Robert Galbraith. And I believe that's coming out next year. Now, the big challenge for the publisher right now is how to get copies into the hands of the public. You certainly have a lot of people who really want this book, and there are no copies in bookstores as of the moment, or at least very few copies in bookstores.
But the ebooks are available.
The ebooks are available, which creates an interesting, and I think for independent bookstores, a very unfortunate situation for them. J.K. Rowling was always a great friend to bookstores. She did not release ebook versions of the Harry Potter books when they were published. The ebook versions came years after the Harry Potter books came out in print. But in this situation, the bookstores are really not very happy about the way that this has played out, because all of their customers who are Rowling fans want this book right now, and it's not available in bookstores because Little Brown is rushing to press to reprint an additional 300,000 copies, which is a huge undertaking. And those copies are not going to be in bookstores for a few more days at least. So a lot of the booksellers I talked to this week said that they were very concerned that people were going to come into the stores, and when they found out that there were no copies available, they would just download the ebook, which is considerably cheaper than the hardcover.
It's like $9.99, right?
$9.99 versus a list price of $26.
But, you know, the ebook marketplace has changed a lot since that, the timing of the Harry Potter ebooks. And particularly for this kind of genre book, which sells very strongly in an electronic version, maybe the thinking has changed, or Rowling's, you know, thinking has changed, because part of the whole interest here is not just the timing of when she wrote this, but also the timing of when this story came out, right?
Right. And in the publishing world, there's certainly a lot of suspicion that this was not just an anonymous leak, that this was actually a very well-plotted marketing campaign to promote the paperback edition of The Casual Vacancy.
Which comes out when?
Which happens to come out next week, which is very fortuitous for Little Brown. So they're getting their author's name in the news. They're getting people going into bookstores and going on Amazon trying to get a book of hers. And if they can't get a copy of The Cuckoo's Calling, perhaps they'll just pick up the paperback of The Casual Vacancy.
That would be very convenient for all.
Extremely.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks.
Mason Williams joins us today to talk about his new book, City of Ambition, FDR, LaGuardia, and the Making of Modern New York. Hi, Mason.
Hi.
So the book is about what period exactly are we talking about?
Well, the bulk of it covers the mayoralty of Fiorello LaGuardia and the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, which are more or less coterminous, 1933 to 1945. It stretches back before that into the Progressive Era, which is the roots of a lot of the policy ideas that are implemented in the 30s and 40s. And at the end, it looks forward into the post-war decades to see what becomes of this period of the city's history.
And you argue in the book that the city of New York benefited enormously from this cooperation between LaGuardia and FDR.
Yes, as indeed many cities did, but New York in particular, perhaps because of how vigorous the LaGuardia administration was in implementing these programs, did certainly benefit tremendously.
It was three times the per capita spending in New York versus Philadelphia and Detroit at the time, right?
Right. There is this interesting division between cities that really put these resources to work and ones that didn't. Chicago and Los Angeles, for instance, chose to really spend vigorously using the New Deal programs. Other cities, Philadelphia and Detroit are two good examples, didn't.
So now Roosevelt obviously had roots in New York, but when you think of the figures of Fiorello and FDR, they seem like very different types.
Very different types. LaGuardia, tongue-in-cheek one time, referred to the pairing as the son of revolution and the son of the steerage. And they were sort of, in some ways, comically mismatched. And yet they had important things in common, philosophically and politically. They learned that they could use each other to mutual advantage. And that's really what underpins their relationship.
And they were both lawyers who built their careers in New York, right?
They were both lawyers, neither one of whom really wanted to be a lawyer. Both of them saw the law as a stepping stone to politics. They had that in mind, I think, pretty much from the beginnings of their careers.
And you have a great opening line in the book where you talk about you take the FDR to LaGuardia Airport if you live in New York. So that's kind of an easy way for us to think about this pairing. But what other aspects, components of New York that we see today are legacies? We know what Robert Moses did to the city, but I don't think we think so much about what the legacy of these two were in the city.
Well, the 30s is an interesting period because so much of what happens in the city has to do with the federal government's decisions about what should be done with all these unemployed workers. So when LaGuardia came into office, perhaps something like a quarter or a third of the city's workforce was out of work.
This is 1933.
1934. And the federal government decides that rather than waiting for these people to be reemployed by private industry or simply sustained on relief, that their labor should be routed through municipal governments. And a lot of what these people do is construction. The FDR Drive is one example. LaGuardia Airport is another. You could go on and on with big infrastructure projects, the Belt Parkway, the West Side Highway, and the Henry Hudson Parkway. But also a lot of smaller neighborhood scale projects also. As we're taping this, it's probably something like 95 degrees outside. Today might be a nice day to go to McCarran Park Pool or Astoria Pool or the pool in Jackie Robinson Park or Hamilton Fish Pool or Orchard Beach or Jacob Riis Beach or the Franklin D. Roosevelt Boardwalk on Staten Island. You know, these are all facilities that New Yorkers still depend on in a lot of ways, all products of this collaboration between Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and Fiorello LaGuardia's progressive administration in New York.
What made LaGuardia so effective at getting this money from FDR, where I'm sure a lot of people were trying to get this WPA project money to their cities?
LaGuardia came from Congress. He had been a congressman all through the 20s. And so he came into office with very sort of expansive ideas of what the federal government and the cities working together could do. So he understood the potentialities of this partnership that Roosevelt, rather, was trying to forge. And he appointed a lot of very able administrators. Moses is the best remembered, of course, and certainly the most important, but there were many others as well. And they were able to draw upon really 3 decades worth of robust thinking by policy people about what government could do to improve the quality of life in America's cities. Then, thanks to Roosevelt's New Deal, resources became available to the city. So you have a combination of things. One is a set of policies that could be drawn upon and implemented quickly, shovel-ready, as we would say nowadays. Then able administrators appointed by LaGuardia. And finally, the last piece to fall into place is this infusion of resources, thanks to Roosevelt's New Deal.
So the ideals and the ideas came from the progressive era and kind of found their match in this new waterfall of money
in the
New Deal. You talked a little bit about the recreation projects, about infrastructure. What about cultural institutions? Was that part of this?
Cultural institutions, very much so. LaGuardia, in his early 20s, had lived in Europe as a consular agent and had seen these state-sponsored operas and music performances and so forth. He himself was the son of a bandleader, and music was very important to him. So he had...
Thus deserving his own musical one day.
Yeah, right. He, whenever he was feeling nervous on election eves, used to go watch the rehearsals of the Philharmonic. But he wanted to create something like what nowadays is Lincoln Center. And he also wanted to create opportunities for working class people to access the arts, which was a sort of a novel concept in 1930s America. But these two impulses joined in the creation of City Center, which got off the ground in part thanks to the Works Progress Administration's series of very inexpensive orchestral concerts in the city. LaGuardia, of course, is also the person who realizes the what's now the LaGuardia School of Music and the Arts. Yes, generally, you know, WNYC gets a second lease on life during the LaGuardia years, and that also becomes a venue through which people can access arts that they otherwise wouldn't have had the opportunity to access.
You said that this goes through, you take this story through World War II, but things changed when the war started. What happened?
What happened, in the simplest possible terms, resources in the 1930s, thanks to national policy, had gone into producing goods and services at the community level. That's what the New Deal New York story is really about. With the coming of war, all that productive energy and those resources have to be shifted to the war effort. So the New Deal really comes to, in some ways, a screeching halt. And yet, new issues come up, which become the grounds for federal and municipal collaboration. Most of these have to do with the cost of living. This is the period of price control and these kinds of things. Rent control in New York dates from World War II. But also equal opportunity to all these jobs that are being created by the government. So another thing that comes out of this period is fair employment practices. The idea that people, African Americans, lead the push, but in New York, Jews and Italians and so forth are also heavily involved, that everyone should have equal access to private employment.
And obviously, you're a historian by training. Recently got your PhD from Columbia, and not a public policy person per se, but it's hard not to look at this and compare it to today.
Right,
it's
right.
Really tough to imagine New York getting this kind of influx of federal support.
It's true. Federal support for municipal governments is sort of withdrawn during the Second World War. It comes back in certain areas after that. Then there's a renaissance during the Great Society and after. But then in the late 70s and early 80s, especially under Reagan, we reach a new sort of permanently low level. The interesting exception to this, which sort of pertains to the mayoral race that's currently going on, is the Affordable Care Act, which actually is going to do quite a lot to support New York City's health efforts. And if you look at some of the candidates' proposals, a lot of it has to do with how the city should implement, you know, Obamacare and use the resources locally that are freed up by that. But that tends to be an exception for sure.
We just had that front page story about how the premiums for New Yorkers are going to go way down under the Affordable Care Act.
Right, right. And this is an illustration of how this relationship between Washington and New York can certainly make things happen for sure. It still remains the case that to do really big things, Washington has to rely on state governments and local governments. You know, you think of the response to Hurricane Sandy, for instance. This is an occasion on which you see a Republican governor of New Jersey and a Democratic president showing that they're willing to work together. And it's because this kind of collaboration is still necessary to do really heavy lifting in the American governmental system.
All right. Well, obviously lots of work to still be done on that front. Thank you, Mason, so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mason Williams, author of City of Ambition, FDR, LaGuardia, and the Making of Modern New York. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So what is new on the list this week?
On the hardcover fiction list this week, there are just three new titles. Down at number 11, Chris Bojalian has a new book. It's called The Light in the Ruins. He writes these kind of Jodi Picoult-type, very issue-oriented books. But he occasionally does turn to historical novels, and this is another one of those. It's set in 1955, and it kind of brings back the ghosts of World War II. It's about a serial killer in Florence. Then at number 5, Catherine Coulter has a new book called Bombshell. It is the 17th book in her FBI series. Coulter is one of these novelists who started out as a romance writer and then kind of like Tammy Hoag got eventually more and more into thrillers and darker type books.
You wonder if the romance drives them to it somehow and they're driven to murder. And
well, I think really a lot of bestselling authors, women especially, turn to romance at the beginning as kind of a training ground. There's a ready audience for it. The publishers are happy to have them write these kind of serials and it teaches them how to write a book, and then once they've done that, they get restless and want to branch out into something, a little bit darker, maybe.
Next up, true crime.
Then at number two this week, the highest ranking newcomer to the hardcover fiction list is Brad Thor, his new novel, Hidden Order, which is also a series novel. It follows his counterterrorism operative, Scott Harvath, who used to be a Navy SEAL. So that's new at number two. Unable to topple Dan Brown, Inferno, which remains at number one on the top of the fiction list after 9 weeks.
Okay, it's hard to top hell. And what about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side, there are just two new books this week, so really not a lot of turnover. At number seven, the Jenny Rivera book, Unbreakable. What's interesting about this book is it's already spent a couple of weeks on the paperback nonfiction list as well as the combined list and the ebook list. Now the hardcover is gaining traction as well. It was released in kind of simultaneously in all formats.
Right, and when we talked about it, we would wondered why it wasn't in hardcover, but it is.
Yes.
Okay.
And then at number five, Chuck Klosterman, who is a cultural critic and of late the New York Times Magazine's ethicist columnist.
That is kind of a tongue twister.
He's got a book out called I Wear the Black Hat, which actually ties into this whole focus on ethics. It is a look at villainy, especially villainy in pop culture. I talked to him for the column this week because one of the things that he looks at in the book is the Bernard Goetz case. Back in 1984, Goetz was called the subway vigilante. He's the one who shot four black teenagers when they approached him for money on a New York subway car. And that case has widely been cited as a precursor to the George Zimmerman case, which Klosterman does not mention at all in the book. And so I wrote to him to ask him what he makes of Zimmerman. And he said, you know, he really thinks that they are not such similar cases. The Goetz case was undeniably a vigilante case. And he compares him to Batman or to Charles Bronson in Death Wish, which a lot of people have made that connection between Bernard Goetz and Death Wish. But Zimmerman, he says, it's a lot harder to make the case for him as a straight up vigilante because he actually went out to look for somebody that he thought might be a criminal. He wasn't reacting to a potential crime. He was putting himself in the situation of seeking it out. He says if there's any similarity there, he would call Bernard Goetz Charles Bronson in the middle of Death Wish and George Zimmerman, Charles Bronson, at the end of Death Wish, after he's just snapped and he's, you know, going out seeking trouble.
Right. The Goetz case at the time was sort of portrayed as this kind of like suppressed urban white rage.
Michael Douglas.
Yeah, exactly. Michael Douglas falling down. Well, after that cheerful discussion of vigilante nonfiction, thank you, Greg.
Sure. Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.